Here, McCoy lays it on the line for Kirk and tells him what his problem is. Nobody has actually stood up to Kirk. We heard that Kirk stood up to an admiral to get the command of the Enterprise back, and now the only person who's on this ship who would dare say this to him finally lays on the line what the essential problem of this movie is. The essential problem of the movie is not that this giant cloud is moving towards Earth. It's that Kirk is disconnected.
View screens are really big in this.
Could this be Spock?
I'd like to know
I don't
why,
know.
when that view screen goes off, is an image of the Partridge Family bus there.
Well, obviously, in the 23rd century,
your wall, your art turns
it's
into
retro.
Turns into your view screen.
Yeah, it's a retro 20th century.
Or it's one hell of a big
again,
game of
I mentioned
Simon.
About the things that Bob used to always hate that I would point out. This shot of the door
closing,
right. I mean, to me, it's so symbolic. Kirk is unenlightened. He's like, that's not why I shot that. I'm like, well, maybe it was. You just didn't know it. And then we go to an even darker shot. Do you remember how dark this movie looked in theaters?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the space was really black in this film. When you were not orbiting a planet, which you aren't at all in this film, other than Earth, there should theoretically not be any light from any stars, which is why Trumbull came up with the concept of the Enterprise illuminating itself. So you go from this Kirk being darkened to the blackness of the space, and then into that comes this Vulcan shuttle. Here's another great bit of Jerry Goldsmith music. Not sure if you can actually see this in the picture, maybe in 70 millimeter, but they never did one. That's the name of that shuttle is actually the Surak.
Yes.
It's announced that it's a Federation registered shuttle. You don't know what it is. It's the music that tells you that it's Spock and that it's Vulcan.
Now, isn't that the only shot, Darren, inside the
inside
deck?
Right.
And here again is this connection. You physically see the models connecting. You'd think it would be just as easy to beam him on, and it would be. But A, we get this theatrical entrance, as I mentioned before, and B, it has that theme of connection. We see the technology connecting to each other, and now the people have to do that too.
There's also a point at this here that the mechanical voices were taken away to, you know, have a human being acknowledge that, you know, there's a border,
well,
that it's not as cold.
We even saw that in the 24th century, they didn't have talking computers. There was a lot of talk about talking computers in the early days of computers in the 20th century. And at the time that the original Star Trek was on the air, well, guess what? We're now in the 21st century. Do we like talking computers? We have them. They don't sound very good.
No.
They talked about getting to HAL, but we didn't get to HAL.
I like 2001.
We don't like them.
I would like a 2001 HAL. And the movie's great.
I'd like a 2001 HAL, too. I just don't want him to kill me.
Especially since the computers, as some of the characters do, state the obvious in a lot of, you know,
right.
We don't need to be told that the negative helm control, you know, 14 times. It was a great idea at the time, and there were science advisors, and we all respected that and respected what Roddenberry was trying to do, which was to update Star Trek and really make us feel that it was a technological wonder, but the technology is useless without the people connecting with each other, working together. Nowadays, we all feel plugged into technology. We all feel like we're part of the matrix, right? But if we were to really get out there and be so far away from Earth and the place that has grass and trees, you know, the only thing we'd have is each other, just a bunch of machines.
So Spock comes back, and he turns out to be a real jerk. And because he's disconnected from himself, he doesn't know who he is. He's trying to be Vulcan. He's trying to be less human.
He thinks he's looking for V'ger,
yeah.
But he's not. He's looking for Kirk.
When we were laying out the project, we were talking about what might have been missing, and that we always felt that Kirk's performance, that he was missing to a certain degree. And I can't, you know, I'm so amazed by the edit here that I really think we found Kirk.
We had to pull out was all these, hope this isn't a G-rated commentary on a PG movie, but we have to take out every instance of Kirk bitching at somebody, which he did several times. Those all came out. His disconnectedness, I think, plays fine and fully there. That cut of Spock walking out cut to Kirk and McCoy, and then boom, you get Sandy Courage's original series theme. It shows you where we need to get to. Mm-hmm. We need to get to Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and that music all being back together.
What we actually found in the script, earlier drafts of the script at least, was that there was a moment where Spock is walking down the hall, and we felt that there was a point where he needed to lose it a little. And there was a point where he walks into a
balcony.
It was like a separate room. I think it was. It might have been a. Well, he just separates himself from everybody.
That's right.
And he loses his composure for a moment. Mm-hmm. And that really showed the pain that he was struggling.
Yeah, because he, as we know, Vulcans have emotions. They just suppress them. And maybe Spock had this unexpected reaction of seeing Kirk and McCoy again.
And Bob's wink just now.
Mm-hmm.
Bob has this amazingly charming wink.
That Shatner was channeling Bob there.
That's clear.
Last time I remember him doing it was when we did the sing-along Sound of Music at the Hollywood Bowl with 18,000 people, and that famous iconic shot of helicopter coming into Julie Andrews. And I looked at him, and he gave me that wink. He knew, you know, power.
I've gotten so much feedback about this officer's lounge shot and the nacelles showing out the window.
We actually talked about going far more elaborate with this set itself, right?
Yeah.
We probably could now. But again, I think it was good that we were restricted. We kept it feeling like the same movie. But that was one that we debated, and ultimately we went for it.
You were saying, Darren?
Well, it's just that, you know, where is this lounge, and what are we seeing behind there, and why are the stars seeming to go sideways and things like that? And this is the view that you would get. I put a camera in our model and put it at this location. We're figuring that this is pretty near the large wreck deck that we saw earlier.
The level above it.
Right. And that this is the upper level of the wreck deck behind the big atrium. And this is the view of the engines that you get with that lens.
So if you physically were on the ship looking out that window, that's what you would see.
Well, we had never seen part of the Enterprise from inside the Enterprise.
You'd never seen the connection of the inside and the outside. And we thought that it
Other than Spock's...
And how they don't give it a second thought. Right. Nobody's standing looking out the window and marveling about it because they look at it every day. I'm reminded here also of the production designer, Hal Michelson, who we lost very recently.
Yeah, just a few
Wonderful, wonderful man. And I remember him talking about this set, how it was basically thrown together. It wasn't anything like the large expanse that it was originally storyboarded as. And he got cardboard boxes from the back lot and upholstered them. And that's what's in the background for a lot of this.
I don't know what to say.
Darren, I must say also the way that the composition ended up here was perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it looked like that was there first, and then then you staged the actors around it. But it was actually done 20 years later. That must be the bar back there. Either that or the perfume counter.
Right.
Samples testing.
You see how they have behind McCoy is a little tubular thing with what looked like greenery in it.
Looks like a hydroponic garden or something.
I'm not going to talk about what Scotty's saying or where it came from, but I did see the subtitles that they put in on the closed caption, the text track.
Yes.
They had no clue what he was saying.
That's good. But you see, originally, I mean, I think that the computer was going red alert over and over and over. It was the red alert for the visually impaired.
Right.
In case you missed the red lights and the people running around.
And the big sign that says red alert.
Right, that there was a voice telling you that the ship was now on red alert.
Right.
Now we start. I love that.
There's
that
the Burger King logo behind it.
Yes, Captain. I lost Starfleet, but in case you want any French fries, I can get some. You know,
yeah, that's not a Burger King logo. That music, it always looked that.
All right, that music that came in on the shot of the cloud on the view screen when they first see it. That incredible pipe organ that was at the Fox scoring stage, which was taken out about 10 years ago. It's the same organ used on The Sound of Music and anything else that was recorded at Fox over the years, going all the way back to the 30s. And it's the haunted house. That's what Jerry's telling you there. This may be a cloud, God knows how big it is. Actually, we know how big it is.
Right.
But
now it's over two AUs in diameter.
Okay, which is twice the distance from Earth.
From the Earth to the sun.
Okay.
So instead of 82 AUs, I think Chuck did a great job getting it down to two. It sounds like a pregnant pause.
But anyway, despite the vastness of that idea, this is really a bunch of kids facing the neighborhood haunted house.
Right.
And what's going to come on if you had a scene like that is this scary organ. You know, Jerry was had this incredible instinct for capturing exactly what you need to be feeling. And in a movie like this, which had so many delays with the effects, and the script was not quite as honed as it could have really been had they taken a little more time with it, but he manages to fill in that those missing links incredibly. There are people, probably from older than we are, who will mention some of Jerry's scores from the 60s as the greatest thing he ever wrote. To me, there's just no competition.
There is no comparison.
No comparison, that's right.
Which is, I always found that amazing considering he didn't have anything to write to. Mm-hmm.
And he did, again, it was very rushed. There was a lot of times where they had no footage. So they would record 7 versions of Ilya's theme.
And
Lionel Newman would come in and record versions of the Star Trek theme.
But they also had the advantage of that they listened to the music and they sent Jerry back a few times to come up with.
Yeah, he did. So there's 6 or 7 cues that didn't work out, and before he came up with the main Star Trek theme, which is now the most famous thing he's ever written,
it became the opening of Next Generation, of course.
He got Sandy Courage himself in to do the quotes of the original Star Trek television show theme, and then later on Sandy became his main orchestrator throughout the 90s. And then I think Fred Steiner, who had written some original series scores, came in to put some of the cues together, like the one that just ended, I believe. Now this scene went through a lot of changes. There were basically 2 different versions of it. There were some mislabeled numbers in the script, so things got edited incorrectly.
To those of you who caught it, this little in joke is the sparks around the warp engine right there. What's funny is years later, I'm not even going to talk about what it is, but if anyone notices that years later, I went to Richard Anderson, who was one of the original sound designers on the film, and it was something that he always intended to put in, but never had time to put it in. And when he saw this version, he was so happy because it was exactly where he was planning to put it.
That's
a little
great
sound effect that was there. Because it's pretty much the only place you can have that effect, that sound effect.
Unless you put it over Chekhov.
That's right. Added footage here of Major Barrett, Mrs. Roddenberry, entering the bridge to tend to Chekhov's wound. And we find out that Ilya has healing ability again. This idea of the physical connection between people, that was missing in the 79 version entirely. We took advantage of one of the unused Jerry Goldsmith cues to put a little score in that sequence. Bob kept saying, I need to see Decker. We need a shot of Decker, who you see him from the neck down there. I went to the cutting script, the continuity script, which has all of the numbers of where all the slates were. And I said, Bob, you did one take of that. And I've had them looking for that number in the cans that came in and that they were looking through. And I said, we can't find it. It just isn't there. I don't think we can get that cut. That's probably the one thing he specifically asked for that we couldn't do. Again, he wanted to foreshadow that what ultimately happens to Decker and Ilya.
Meanwhile, in space.
Now we get back to, some slight recutting here to what it was originally, because, again, there was some interactive lighting that didn't match up because of mislabeled slates. And you had a shot of Decker that didn't match up with, he was leaning over the desk in one shot and standing there looking at the screen in another shot. And then it all climaxed with an effect that didn't come in.
An effect that looked like, well, in the final film, that was a jump cut.
Well, like a light bulb
to nothing on the screen. And we finally have a sound effect for the transmission there.
And I would never, ever have any problem believing that that wasn't done in 1979.
Yeah.
That was one of the most prominent goals, was that we don't go over the top, you know, showing off what's possible now. It was to embrace everything that was possible at the time and match it to be that you can't tell what was new, what was old, what we pulled an effects element and reused, what was computer generated or not, what, you know, it was, the goal was that everything would be flawless and invisible to the viewer. It's the greatest compliment.
Or at least as flawed as the original footage.
Right. Or as dirty as the original footage, for that matter.
That's why we did have to put like a grain pass onto things to match it, right?
Yeah, we've passed, the film was supposed to go through a much, much more serious dirt and cleanup, but in the end, what was released was released, and we felt that everything needed to be consistent also, just to make it match. You couldn't have one suddenly pristine, clean shot where everything else is dirty.
Again, that last exchange that just took place there between Kirk and Spock and Decker, that was originally cut out of the film. The reason why things were cut out of the film is because part of the deal of meeting that date was also meeting a running time of precisely not to exceed 130 minutes maximum. And when the effects work was not in, they needed to cut back dialogue in order to accommodate it when it did come in. Of course, then, as said before, not having any opportunity to weigh one against the other and decide maybe we can cut some of these long effects and put back in some of this dialogue that we trimmed. There was never that opportunity. So that's the reason why a lot of those things were cut. Put in on a network broadcast in the early 80s, the fans had a very positive reaction to it, so much so that Paramount released that version on videotape, and it was the official version. Bob was not informed about it, and so he was not happy about it, really, because of the state that it was in. It was sort of, it was almost like a work print cut into it, and then we found that they even did that to some prints.
It was a Sit Long and Prosper.
Remember the first
the
show
off
in 91?
They actually went back in and took, with the exception of Kirk leaving the Enterprise, they printed those sequences and reincorporated them into the prints. And
so when we called,
even when we went to
the
studio and said, we want to make sure we get Bob's theatrical cut, they said, absolutely, we have that one. And they delivered it to us, and we actually found that it was the best prints that they had, which was the Sit Long and Prosper.
Right, which I wasn't opposed
marathon.
To seeing.
Well, Bob wanted to look at his film as this is
right.
The way I left it. That's where it became so difficult for Bob through this process, and even up to his death.
To figure out what the movie was.
No, but I mean, he did. He finished the film in the form of the director's edition, and he's so happy with the film. And it's funny, he'd had a smile that I hadn't seen in him smile a certain way for anything but how proud he was of this project. And it touched my heart when the publicist from Paramount handed us a photo where it captured that, that moment, and it was amazing. But the problem is that today the film is still being seen in the rough cut version from 79.
Right, it's shown on the high def and satellite channels, right?
And special longer version, of course, was out, but I haven't seen that being shown any other way. But the original version isn't Bob's finished picture, and you know it does have a historical significance. But if you did work that couldn't be completed, and then you completed the work, you'd want people to appreciate what your overall final goal was, which was Bob's goal to have this be and stand as the final and finished version of the movie. So when people think of Star Trek: The Motion Picture by Robert Wise, this is what they get, and that's what he wanted. And you know, it's still disappointing to see that other version is still being seen. Not that it doesn't have historical significance, but you know, you finish the film, you want people to see it the way that it was intended.
Well, I think eventually we'll get to a point where it is done. I'm optimistic about it getting done. And I think that the other film should be preserved as well, because I remember cutting school to go see it the day it opened. And I'll tell you, it's not in the way that I cut school. I was the kind of kid who handed in term papers way ahead of the due date. But I cut school the day this opened by telling the teacher that I had that I'm not coming to class tomorrow, I'm going to see Star Trek. And she said, okay. So I went to school actually till the first couple classes till noon, then left. Went to go see it opening day.
I know that that you guys have mentioned this. I think I'm in agreement that, at least by now, with some of the comments, that I'd like to see some type of high-definition box set that does have the original version so that can be appreciated and then has...
Well, I mean, on the DVD of this that came out, all...
the director's edition.
The clips from the original version and the TV version, for that matter, were included there. But the focus, having multiple versions on that release, would have taken the emphasis away from this, and I think that was the whole point of this release, was to say, this is the director's edition. Now, I think it has sold itself. People really like it. There's no way that anybody can look at it and not see it as a valuable commodity. To somebody, as I said before, who had never seen Star Trek, they would, for a million reasons, would be more attracted to this version. There's no reason to not release it. And I think, you know, we've gotten into the home video industry enough to get to the point where we can just put all the existing versions there in one set. Be nice.
Here we have the the introduction of the V'ger vessel itself, and that, of course, was done by Dykstra's team.
Right, we made a transition there through that cloud sequence, which was Trumbull's team, right, coming into Dykstra, who did the physical model of the V'ger craft. Now, these sequences are very interesting because, again, they came under a lot of criticism by people over the years, even people who like the film, that you spend 3-4 minutes going through a cloud, you spend 3-4 minutes traveling across a vessel. And again, they were kept at that length because the footage was cut first, before effects work came in. Then when those effects shots came in, they were simply dropped into the holes waiting for them. Jerry scored it, and out it went. You know, I can't say enough about Jerry, who he had a reputation of being very, very gruff, but I gotta say, for the number of times that I got together with him over this project, I thought he was just the dearest man, very, very funny. We had a fantastic experience of debuting 20 minutes of this version of the film at the Hollywood Bowl with my good friend John Malcherry conducting the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra.
Featuring the live performance of the blaster beam instrument.
Right, which we found Craig Huxley came in and brought the beam. And
you should talk about the call you made to him about, do you have a blaster beam?
But getting that actually on the stage and doing several cues, 20 minutes worth of footage, and sitting there with Bob Wise and Jerry. And we also did sections from Planet of the Apes that night and Alien.
Yeah. There was nothing in my life like seeing the premiere of your work
and 18,500
people with your director and your composer and just showing these amazing things to everybody. And just
we were joined that night by a couple of other fantastic people. John Povel, who was the associate producer on the film, was actually on the project with as Roddenberry's assistant back when it was going to be a TV series, and his wife Michelle, who is the first person to speak English in the film, right? I think she's the communications officer at Epsilon 9, who first reports on this Klingon listening, their spy satellite into the Klingon Empire.
Now, this sequence was trimmed down slightly.
Yeah, again, I started to talk about that, and of course went off on a tangent, but... it was very obvious candidates when you for cutting down, because you could still tell the story and significantly gain back some of your running time to put back some dialogue in. And we had an extraordinary benefit on this because I told Bob what I wanted to do. I said, here's the opportunity here is to not mess too much with the music. I could go in and not look at the picture and do a music edit on it, bring these two cues down, and then recut the picture to that, because the music is really what drives it sonically. It's the dominating element of these two sequences. So I spoke to Jerry about that, and he said, I always expected that some of those scenes would be cut down, so I deliberately wrote music that would lend itself to that, with a lot of these repeating patterns. And I should also point out that this V'ger motif that we hear, some of it is a dark version of Ilya's theme. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is in the time signature of 6/8, which again helps us with that whole motif
six,
of
right.
this, of the sixes, that everything has to do with V'ger seems to revolve around. But of course, Jerry says, no, I had no idea about that.
It's funny, the only piece of V'ger that I ever saw on this show was we just passed a circular dish that was being held by another little long
right.
extension coming from the right, but in the circle was there. And I was visiting Pat McClung once, and he pulled out of a closet, you know, this little thing about the size of the headpiece of the Staff of Ra, little circle and piece. Just surprising that it was just a small.
By the way, this shot, I need to interrupt you, Dave, because this is, you know, in every project there are things that get away that you can't do. This was one.
It's one of the ones that Bob said.
Yeah, that was on our list.
If we ever go back.
It was on our list. We had to give a few things back. And the Enterprise actually needs to do a 180-degree turn there so that it's then facing the end of V'ger, which was the order that Kirk gave. We simply weren't able to make that change there.
This is one of our shots.
Now, this was a really, really difficult scene. Because we kept trying to find the original element to go back and print it a little bit.
Wasn't this filmed like as a reflection?
Well, it was filmed as a reflection in folded Mylar. This
right.
shot right here, where it's going in the foreground across, we actually had to stabilize each side of the frame because the left-hand side popped.
Independently of the right.
Right, independently of the right. And in doing so, I was a little concerned because the probe, in order to keep the left and right-hand side stable, the probe in the center would have to be wider. And what we actually realized in doing that was that it was kind of okay because it was in the foreground, whereas before it was just the same size as it was anywhere else in the entire sequence. But because it was in the foreground, it was okay for it to be wider. So it just kind of worked. But this whole sequence, was digitally touched to make it work a little better and be a little bit more
stable. Shooting it in the Mylar and then having to do the optical processing on it, I mean, it got all unstable. And if you were to compare this to what the film originally had, I mean, it just was all over the place in terms of registration. And Darren and I talked about, not that long ago, I don't think, about how the distortion that you do get around the axis of that probe kind of lends itself to what's going on, because you would expect that this thing is so bright, it's so full of energy, that
that its energy field might even be distorting light or, you know, matter
or
around
optical.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is also where we lost one of the security guards in the original assembly of the film.
Right.
That was
where
taken
did he
out.
Come from? He come
yeah.
from.
And that was taken out because at the end of the film, Uhura has to give the casualty list, right? And she has to say, or Kirk does.
Right.
And he has to say Decker, Ilya, and Ensign so-and-so.
Right.
And it's just like, well, who's that? Why do we care? It just took away from the impact that we lost two of our main characters.
And these are some great animation effects by Robert Swarth and his animation team. The moiré pattern that was established for the energy patterns of V'ger.
We were also talking about if we actually did find the original film footage that they used, it probably wouldn't work as well as the distortion for that scene
right.
with the brightness and how everything looked different, because it's so radically different when you get to disappearing.
I was going to look at this shot where Kirk has the tricorder.
Yeah, it hands it off to Ensign
hey,
Hand.
Thank you, Finn.
And again, the reason for that distortion and the reason why they shot it in the pellicle or the Mylar sheet was that they basically pressed it to eliminate the gigantic light rig and the operator that was walking around the bridge.
There was one shot even where the elbow of the operator,
there was one shot where you could see the elbow and we removed it.
And there was another shot where I think the shadow underneath the bottom of mm-hmm. it, I think that might still be there, but it goes by so fast.
Which brings up a really funny thing that Darren and I discovered while we were looking through the photos of the models, of what models existed from this film. And we found that probably sold at auction now at Paramount, but we found that light rig still exists in the archive that they walked around the bridge.
That's funny.
I think, when are you going to reuse this thing?
Right. Well, for the next time, V'ger.
That's right. But it was funny that after all these years, it's still there.
Here's Marcy Lafferty, who was Bill Shatner's wife at the time, as Chief DeFalco, replacing Ilya at the Navigator Station. I love this cue by Jerry. With that shot where they first got tractor beamed in, there's a great sampling of the beam, the big long block of wood with strings.
When you guys want to explain how it really works, the baseball bat and everything,
just take a bat and whack it.
It's a giant electric guitar, 18 feet long, and it's this big aluminum box with strings on it.
Mm-hmm.
And
the thing I always found interesting is that...
And you had an artillery shell that you'd hold on the...
tune it.
Right.
And
you'd move it back and forth.
And then somebody hit it with a baseball bat to get the sound.
I loved that John Malcheri had that demoed before we did the sequence from Star Trek, which was great. But I also love the fact that that's... it was a very revolutionary idea, and it really makes this score memorable in a similar way that the score for The Day the Earth Stood Still in 1951 by Bernard Herrmann was revolutionary for the theremin, which was where you passed your hands through the sound wave, and it made that kind of sound. Oh, here's a composite of... 65 millimeter Enterprise footage with VistaVision V'ger model footage.
I also think this is one of the shots that we color timed to shut off the warp engines.
Right. I don't think was it that one?
I believe that was one of the mic.
I think we did a couple of them.
I'm just marveling.
Can you imagine how? I mean, you know, people don't have to deal with labs now when they do effects work. They sit at computers and the computers do their thing.
This is another one.
That one definitely.
Darren, explain because.
I actually believe, guys, that it was this shot was the first one, not the previous one. I think the previous one was correct.
That could be.
Well, the point was that...
Kirk orders the engines to be shut down. Right. And when it launched from dry dock,
when the warp engines are off, the deflector dish...
The main drive engines.
Right, he had
thrust at least going. In this film.
In this film,
God,
yes,
we
that's
sound
right.
Like such geeks.
Well, yeah. That's
no,
what
but
happens.
We have to.
But the deflector dish light is colored more gold hued.
It's blue when the impulse from the main drive and the warp engines are online, and he orders them shut down. So therefore, at that point, it should be gold, not blue.
And it was mostly consistent with that in the film, except for a number of shots where that wasn't, where it wasn't accurate. And while we were doing the transfer of the
notice
film,
the 6 points,
we adjusted the color of the deflector dish, which is kind of funny. It's a way of our, we've actually been able to tell if that was same transfers being used, and the high def that's being presented right now, the original version, has the other colored deflector dish from when we did the transfer.
Now that we're inside V'ger, this was again taken over by Trumbull's group. And I believe that this miniature was actually headed up by Greg Jean.
And it looks very similar to some of their work together on Close Encounters. Mm-hmm. And again, it had that six-sided, almost Star of David imagery there. The editor on this film was Todd Ramsey, who I worked with also and interviewed him for a documentary on the making of John Carpenter's The Thing. And he was an apprentice editor on the Hindenburg, and which Bob did just prior to this. And then he was given the task of his first feature film to edit, being Star Trek the Motion Picture. And incidentally, first of all, he was part of this endeavor as well, and liked everything that we were doing and made some suggestions of his own and was very supportive, and it was great to have him aboard with us.
And he was very, very complimentary of saying, you know, if Bob, anything Bob wants to do.
Right. You know. It made him look better. In fact, one little piece of trivia is that the voice of Starfleet Command after the transporter accident is Todd Ramsey's voice. But
that was not actually intended. It was that they were in such a rush that he threw that in as a temp.
And there it was.
And then when he saw the film, the
motion picture,
there was this line there, and he was going, wait a second, how did...
But interesting history around this film is that Bob Wise, for anybody who doesn't know, was the editor of Citizen Kane at the start of his long, illustrious career, which was done for Orson Welles at RKO in 1941. The room was that it was cut in, that he worked in, was at the corner of Melrose Avenue and Gower Street in Hollywood, which is the southwest corner of the Paramount facility now. It was then RKO. And if people won't be bored by some history, that lot, when RKO went under as a movie studio, was purchased by Desilu, Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, who had made a fortune on I Love Lucy, and in a brilliant business deal, Desi Arnaz held on to the ownership of the negatives of I Love Lucy, which then became valuable when television grew and new stations came into the market, and then suddenly the rerun was invented. And then he, in the late 50s, sold the I Love Lucy negatives back to CBS, and with that money he purchased RKO, turned it into Desilu Studios, and it was there that Star Trek was made, and they went into the TV production business with Mission Impossible and the Andy Griffith Show and Danny Thomas and The Untouchables, lots of shows. That's where Star Trek came to be made and was part of. And then in 1967, Desilu was sold to Gulf and Western, as was Paramount, which coincidentally was the lot next door. So literally they knocked the wall down, and what was RKO and Paramount was now, all became Paramount, 1967, which is how they got Star Trek. So when the movie was made, the film originally in 79 was edited by Todd Ramsey in the very same room that Bob cut Citizen Kane. We, unfortunately, didn't get to work there when we did the director's edition. We were in a building, the Paul Hager post-production building. It was really fantastic to have Bob coming back to that lot where he got his start. And in fact, the building, which is called, I think it's the Valentino Building, was an apartment house when Marathon Street was there. And apartment houses and private homes were there. And Bob's first apartment was in the it was on Marathon Street in the what is now the Valentino Building. So it was really a homecoming for him to come back where he to the lot where he first came on in 1938, I think it was, carrying film cans around as an editorial assistant. And then, of course, a little parking lot and billboard company called Viacom eventually grew into becoming a media conglomerate and bought Paramount and CBS. And so now CBS has Star Trek as well as I Love Lucy and other Desilu shows.
I always loved walking on the corner of the lot and seeing that they kept the RKO globe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's still there.
That's still up over there.
Very historic area.
I also remember, I think we used this in the docs, but Majel explaining how when they brought Star Trek into to Lucy, she was commenting that Star Trek, and she envisioned that this was a show that they followed stars around, like they were going to have people following right. her around. So she greenlit the show.
Right.
What a simple little mistake.
Yep. She was the first female head of a TV production facility. Majel was a good friend of hers because she was part of the Desilu Players. So there's a lot of history there, a lot of great Hollywood, old Hollywood history there. And it all led to this film.
That wall behind them we've seen in every other Star Trek.
I think so, yes.
Incarnation since.
To go back a little bit, we're now dealing with Persis Kambada playing the probe manufactured in the image of Ilia, whom it absorbed. And the sequence where she appears in the sonic shower in what we presume is her own chambers, I guess her own quarters.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a change was made there basically just to the sound, because you had initially the computer voice reading the temperature in the shower. Whereas the point really should have been about the appearance of this, what amounts to a robot, in the image of Ilia. And again, it's like this technology has literally taken over. She's not human, but you know what I mean. Technology has superseded, you know, a physical living being. And that's the danger that this entire crew faces. They have to get past that. They have to conquer that. They have to not let that happen to them.
It's also interesting that the earlier scripts had Ilia as Tasha.
That's right.
Which I assume was the name that...
There's a lot of riffs in this that were, to coin a phrase, I guess our term, Roddenberry-isms. This relationship between Decker and Ilia was really redone in the pilot episode of Star Trek The Next Generation 8 years later, Encounter at Farpoint, with Will Riker. Mm-hmm. Even the way that the names that Roddenberry comes up with are similar. And as Dave pointed out, Tasha... wasn't that originally the name for Troy? And
yes.
Did they switch? Okay, yeah. So, I mean, they were all riffs. To a degree, Roddenberry was... this was Roddenberry's vision of Star Trek, this movie, really, more than almost anything else. And he supervised the first season of The Next Generation, and you really saw that influence and what he was going for, to the point where he wanted to use Jerry's theme song, even though Dennis McCarthy, who's a good friend of yours, Dave, right? Mm-hmm. Wrote a theme, but it was rejected and replaced with Jerry's theme.
The electronic hopscotch.
Yes, that's right. Digital hopscotch, used to say.
The one that we were in production, there were so many people who were coming up with this crazy idea that since Enterprise was coming up, that we were going to go back into those pictures on the rec deck and take out
that
the second
Enterprise history Enterprise panel and replace
and
it,
put it in
an XO1.
Yeah, the Enterprise. And they were so sure that was going to happen. And there was never any communication to do it. There was never any plan to do it. I don't think we would have done it had they even asked at the time, because it wasn't necessary.
Now, okay, in addition to Digital Hopscotch, Dave, you also had a name for this game.
Yeah, building, creating the Fortress of Solitude.
Right. If we had a closer shot of that, you'd see these little crystalline things rising up. You know, but
actually, wasn't it you who came up with that one?
Oh,
there?
Listen, have we broken through technology and maybe made a little, have we reached the human spirit?
I think she's just realizing that all these games are really boring.
But no, you have
the
to
machine,
play it with four people.
The machine is going to take over. You know, you have to really give credit to her performance in these scenes. She's walking around in something that, if the wind blows the wrong way, you really we would be into R, okay? Not PG. In high heels, okay? And with this tiny little wire around her neck holding that little red light.
We added the interior V'ger out the window there.
There were lots of angles of that, and there was supposed to be all this activity and stuff going around, which reminded me on the printed page of kind of like the Krell from Forbidden Planet, of all this machinery and stuff moving around. Again, it was like originally supposed to be much, much more elaborate, and there's a great artist named Robert McCall, who was brought in to design a lot of concepts for the interior V'ger and what all that technology was doing.
Right, particularly for the Spock walk later on.
Mm-hmm. And for the climax.
Right.
And that went back, actually, to when it was a TV pilot,
what
right?
What a gorgeous shot.
There's the... Dave is giving me the motion here. This is Jerry doing the
windshield wiper.
The Enterprise windshield wipers. Now, we had a lot of fun when we did this project. And, again, we mentioned the continuity of Enterprise. We joked in some lighter moments about doing our own bit of continuity, and one joke was to replace this guy with Mr. Arix from Star Trek the Animated Series.
I thought that would have been a great idea, but...
But here, I love this when they go out of frame, you wonder, what
Why
are they
is
doing
Spock
there?
Going down
What's
there?
He doing yeah. there?
Maybe he held that a little bit long. Again, focus on the people, the relationships. This scene was... edited with Bob together from two different versions of the scene that had seen previously. And again, that physical connection here is something touching something else. That's a motif that just goes all through this film. She eventually takes it off. She doesn't want that connection.